a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. All right, first things first, no news from SCOTUS. What is going on with Snope versus Brown, the challenge to Maryland's semi-auto ban? Then you've got Ocean State Tactical versus Nerona, which is the challenge to Rhode Island's ban on large capacity magazines. No news from the Supreme Court in the orders released on Monday morning. Now, it is possible, I guess, we could get a random order from the court later today, maybe even tomorrow, but nothing from the court's official orders from last Friday's conference. So, assuming that both of these cases get relisted, this is going to be list number seven for Snope, maybe lucky number seven for Snope. And this will be, I believe, the eighth list for Ocean State Tactical versus Nerona. Both of these cases first heard in conference in December of 2024. And I talked about this with our guest today, Larry Keene from the National Shooting Sports Foundation. I had the opportunity to sit down with Larry on Friday. Talked a little bit about what's going on at the Supreme Court, most notably about Smith & Wesson versus Mexico, which the Supreme Court will hear in oral arguments tomorrow morning, 10 a.m., as the gun makers trying to dismiss Mexico's $10 billion lawsuit filed against many major manufacturers, blaming them for the cartel violence south of the border. But in addition to talking about that with Larry, we also spoke about the pause on export licenses that not just the firearms industry, but basically every industry subjected to over the past couple of weeks. And we've got some good news to report on that as well. So a pretty wide ranging discussion with Larry Keene from the National Shooting Sports Foundation. Take a look and a listen. Larry, thanks so much for coming on the program today. It's good to see you, sir.
Always a pleasure to spend time with you, Cam.
And we have a lot of stuff to talk about. I want to get your thoughts on this review that is underway by Attorney General Pam Bondi as to ATF and DOJ regulations. But before we get to that, can we talk about what's going on with the export licenses for firearms right now?
Sure. At the beginning of the month, around February 5th, I believe, BIS put a sort of temporary pause on the processing of export licenses for all products across the board, not just for our industry. I think, as I understand it, that was in response to the president's January 20th executive orders, one of which touched upon like reviewing export licensing processes, procedures, in anticipation of a new undersecretary for export administration and a new assistant secretary of BIS, which has not yet happened. The Trump administration people have been nominated and are in the process of having hearings and Senate votes. So they put in place put the licenses on hold without action, HWA. And that, again, was not just for our products. It was across the board. Obviously, you know, the entire exporting community was like, what's going on? And no one has ever seen a pause like this, you know, in the change of administration. So it was unusual. But NSSF reached out and I spoke with the acting assistant secretary to find out what was going on, to explain our concerns and the impact it was having on industry. And last Friday, late Friday afternoon, I was informed that the pause, if you will, had been lifted and that licenses, certainly for our products, were now being what's called staffed or sent out for interagency review by state, DOD, and others. And that if the interagency review approved issuance of the license, that would take place without any further delay. So they're working through the backlog that had built up since February 5th. So it lasted about 2 weeks or so. We're very glad that we were helping our members and the industry get the pause lifted so they can get back to doing business. And then I had another conversation with BIS on Thursday. just yesterday about the same issue, and it was confirmed again that the licenses that were being held were being processed. And I've heard from industry members as recently as this morning that licenses had been approved, very quickly. So I'm glad to see that things are back to normal.
Okay, that is good news to report. Now, I'm curious, have you had any conversations? Obviously, you mentioned your conversation with the BIS. Have you had any conversations with Kash Patel, the new acting director of the ATF yet?
I have not had direct conversations with Director or ATF Acting Director Kash Patel, who's only sworn in on Monday.
Right.
But we've been in communication with the Hill, with Department of Justice. We are, as you mentioned, looking forward to seeing what comes of the executive order. We're certainly encouraged by it. We're encouraged to see that there's an acting director, whether that will be permanent or long term, or whether a placeholder remains to be seen. But we expect to see significant progress on addressing many of the overreaches by the Biden administration, ATF, like repealing the engaged in the business rule, which has already been enjoined as exceeding their statutory authority. We believe that's a correct ruling, and so we want to see that rule repealed in its entirety, rip it out at the roots. We want to see the brace rule rescinded. We want to see zero tolerance, obviously, should go away immediately. That should be, ripped out at the roots. I believe it will be. And a host of other things. I understand there is a new ATF chief counsel that will begin on Monday. So we're looking forward to seeing that and helping to get ATF, back on its core mission of going after bad guys and trigger pullers and not harassing and attacking gun owners and the industry. So we're looking forward to new leadership, better leadership, and getting ATF course corrected. So we'll see what comes of it. Whether it happens exactly in 30 days or not, I don't know, but we're looking forward to it.
Speaking of attacks on the industry, oral arguments in Smith and Wesson versus Mexico on Tuesday before the Supreme Court. Any thoughts on that?
Well, we're very pleased that the Supreme Court granted cert in the case. We think that the district court got it right in dismissing the case based on the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act. We think the First Circuit's decision reinstating the case is egregiously wrong in this theory of aiding and abetting theory that they crafted to try to shoehorn it into the predicate exception. That decision by the First Circuit is squarely at odds with the Supreme Court's precedent just last term in a Twitter case where they articulated what's required for a violation of federal aiding and abetting statute. And, the fact that some bad guys might use Twitter, for example, or a social media site does not make Twitter or Facebook responsible for the actions of the criminals. That's not aiding and abetting because some criminal might misuse the platform. And the fact that lawful business practices by the industry that are, of course, heavily regulated, all licensed, and the federal government approves background check before an individual can obtain a firearm from a licensee is not aiding and abetting the criminal acts of cartels who might steal firearms, who might illegally straw purchase unbeknownst to retailers. I mean, they don't come in with a sign that says, I'm here to straw purchase,
Right.
and then give those guns to others who illegally smuggle them out of the country into Mexico in violation of US law, in violation of Mexican law, then turn them over to cartel members in Mexico, who then, at some point in the future, use those to create harm in Mexico. The industry is not liable for that any more than Budweiser is liable for drunk driving accidents, even if they occur in Mexico.
Yeah.
So we're optimistic, but we take nothing for granted. But I think we are likely to prevail because we have the law on our side, we have the Constitution on our side, and we have common sense on our side. You cannot blame manufacturers for the subsequent criminal misuse of a, lawfully sold in a highly regulated environment product any more than you can sue a bat manufacturer if somebody uses a bat to harm somebody, or a knife manufacturer who uses a knife to harm somebody. It's equally foreseeable to those industries and manufacturers that some small sliver of the universe will misuse the product for harm, but foreseeability is not the test under the law for proximate cause, which is required in order to find somebody liable. Your conduct has to have been the proximate cause of the injury, and that requires a direct connection. It can't just be some remote misuse of the product far, far, far removed from your lawful practices or business practices, which again are highly regulated. So we're really optimistic, fingers crossed, that we will prevail in this case. And it's very important because if we don't, then I am sure you will see other countries file suit against the industry as well, looking to cash in. We know Mexico has been recruiting other countries to file suit in the Caribbean and Central and Latin America. And so, we're concerned about that. And, people talk about, the $10 billion in damages, which would crush the industry. It's equally important that this is, trampling upon U.S. sovereignty. You have a foreign country coming into a U.S. courtroom seeking an injunction from a federal court in Boston, far, far removed from Mexico geographically, to dictate how firearms are designed, which firearms can be sold, how they are to be sold, to whom they are to be sold. And so, this is exactly the same thing we saw in the city lawsuits 20, 25 years ago, where cities were trying to usurp, have courts usurp the role of the legislature and make these policy choices. Many courts correctly rejected it at the time, but Mexico's lawsuit is identical in all respects to what occurred with the city lawsuits. And there's a reason for that. And that is because the architect of the city lawsuits is the same lawyer now representing Mexico. He's taken his failed act on the road and encouraged the foreign sovereign to sue the industry.
Jonathan
And
Lowey, right? Formerly of the
yes,
Brady Campaign, now with what is it, Global Action Against Violence or something like that.
he left Brady, which was involved in the original filing of the Mexican lawsuit, to start his own international gun control group to sue the industry and actively recruit other countries to join in and file suit against the industry. Under the First Circuit's holding, there's nothing to stop any other country from jumping in. And what was really rich recently, when President Trump declared the Mexican cartels and MS-13 as foreign terrorist organizations, the president of Mexico, who is a protege of the prior president of Mexico, Mr. AMLO, she would have to like expand her lawfare against the industry by, accusing the industry of aiding and abetting the terrorist, and that they would somehow go after what she considered the finding, the designation of them as foreign terrorist organizations, as invading Mexican sovereignty, which I found rather ironic and rich, right?
Well, I mean, well, listen, AMLO's policy was hugs, not bullets, right? That was his strategy of dealing with the cartels.
That was his policy after he took millions of dollars in campaign contributions from the cartels, as was outlined in a piece by ProPublica. hardly a conservative pro-industry publication.
Right.
So it's ironic for her to say that, you know, that's invading Mexican sovereignty when she's trying to do precisely that to
Well,
the United States.
absolutely. And, you know, and going back to, again, I mean, you talked about, you know, how the cartels are acquiring U.S. made firearms. There's one area, though, that I don't think you mentioned, and that is legal sales to the Mexican government, to the Mexican military, that are then being diverted in Mexico to the cartels, right? We know that this is happening. We know that the corruption is so rife that a certain number of guns that are, again, legally transferred, legally purchased by the Mexican government, end up in the hands of the cartels. So, I mean, you could make that same argument that, well, why isn't the Mexican government the proximate cause for cartel violence? Why are they not aiding and abetting cartel violence?
Well, you're correct. Many, many, many years ago, there was a report that at least 150,000 Mexican soldiers had defected to go work for the cartels, stealing from Mexican government arsenals their firearms. That was a decade or more ago. So obviously that number is significantly increased. And you know what? Guns don't get traced. The guns lawfully sold to the Mexican government, you know, under a license, they never get traced. And they know which guns they are because there are markings on those guns that indicate that they're the property of the Mexican government, right? Those guns don't get traced, right? And so, you know, they like to distort the numbers and make it seem like more guns that are being misused are coming solely or, you know, or 90%. The number keeps vacillating from the United States. They don't trace all guns. And the guns that they trace don't always come from the United States. They come from a variety of sources. And what's not talked about is the fact that many of those firearms are very, very old, the so-called time to crime. I remember back in the mid, you know, the late 2000s, when this became a big issue under the Obama administration, which itself illegally exported guns to Mexico in Fast and Furious, that the time to crime was like 15 years. And they complained about, well, you know, it's the expiration of the assault weapons ban, so-called assault weapons ban. But the guns that were they were talking about had gone to Mexico prior to the ban being put in place. So if they were being, you know, if they were flooding across the border, they were moving at glacier-like speed. So, but one last point. She's threatened to expand her lawsuit to accuse the industry of aiding and abetting the cartels. Well, she ought to go read her own complaint because that's exactly what she's already alleged in the case in Mexico.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to seeing the oral arguments next Tuesday. I think it's going to be fascinating. And, and like you, I am hopeful that the Supreme Court is going to agree with what Judge Saylor in the U.S. District Court said and dismiss this case. Because you're right. If they don't, this does open the door for further attacks. You've got an organization that as you say, Jonathan Lowey has created this organization that is specifically designed to, you know, foist more of these lawsuits on the criminal justice system and to target the U.S. firearms industry. So this is a critically important case, not just for the manufacturers themselves, but for the consumers, for the purchasers, for those of us who are exercising our Second Amendment rights.
Well, as I said in a recent blog, in response to the threats by the Mexican president, that she ought to be very careful what she wishes for, because let's assume worst case scenario, the case is allowed to go forward. Well, then it goes into discovery. And guess what? Discovery is a two-way street. So we'll get to take discovery of Mexico and its corruption and, you know, the allegations that the prior president took a bribe from the cartels to go easy on them.
Right.
What's happening, you know, with corruption in Mexico. Just recently, a Mexican general who was arrested by DEA in the United States for being the Mexican godfather for the cartels stood on stage in his uniform right next to the president of Mexico. So everyone knows that corruption in Mexico is, you know, systemic. Unfortunately, I feel bad for the Mexican people because the cartels are in control of large portions of the country geographically. They're unable to protect themselves from the cartels because despite the fact that the Mexican Constitution actually has Second Amendment-like language in it, no one realizes that. it's not honored by the Mexican legal system. So, you know, there's only one gun store in all of Mexico, and it's on an army base,
Right.
and severely restricted. I remember being told, what, you know, 15 years ago by high-ranking folks at ATF, that they're, you know, guns have been going over the border into Mexico illegally for forever, because Mexican citizens can't acquire firearms. So, like, there are guns legally exported to Mexico to the military. There are guns the cartels smuggle into Mexico, and then there are guns that get smuggled into Mexico by otherwise law-abiding Mexican citizens for their own self-protection because they don't have a Second Amendment right to protect themselves.
Right. Yeah. And these, I mean, let's call them civilian defense forces, right? I mean, this has been a feature of Mexican life for at least 15 years that I can recall,
Yeah, you see
where,
Mexican
communities
militias.
will band together and they will say, we don't want the cartels coming in.
Right.
And they're not using 22 caliber rifles, they're not using 32 caliber pistols. They may very well be breaking the law in acquiring these firearms, but they're doing so not to commit acts of violence, not to terrorize the country, but to protect their families. And because the government, as you say, of Mexico is not abiding by its own constitutional edict that the people have the right to keep and bear arms. So I think you're spot on with that. And I read a story even as recently as last year. I cannot remember what town it was, but it was, I think, in Jalisco. The Mexican government disarmed the local police force because the corruption was so endemic that they couldn't trust that the guns were going to stay in the hands of the police. So they said, well, you guys don't get to have guns because that's how bad the corruption is there. So, when you talk about discovery being a two-way street, again, I hope it doesn't get to that point. But if it does,
Your lips.
yeah, right. All right, Larry, listen, I really appreciate you coming on the program, sir. Look forward to doing this again very, very soon.
Sure.
And again, thanks so much for everything you do, sir.
It's always good to be with you. And you know, preseason has started.
That's right. We'll talk again soon. Larry Keene from the National Shooting Sports Foundation joining us here on Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My thanks to Larry for joining me on the program today. Looking forward to having him back again very soon. I should mention, by the way, just a programming note. So I wasn't thinking, and I am off tomorrow. I have a couple of appointments that I really cannot get out of. So we will not have a show tomorrow. Oral arguments in Smith & Wesson versus Mexico start at 10 a.m., should last an hour at the Supreme Court. So we'll be talking about those oral arguments on Wednesdays, Cam and Company. And my colleague Tom Knighton will have coverage of the oral arguments at bearingarms.com tomorrow. Yeah, it was one of those things I was trying to rearrange my schedule, just can't make it work. So can't be in two places at once. And I hate having to be off when we've got some breaking news, but we will get back to it and cover it on Wednesday's Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. All right, now on to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. Let's see, we'll start there with a case out of Chicago from the website CWB Chicago. River North robber was wearing an electronic monitoring bracelet for another attempted robbery. Huh, how about that? So, as CWB Chicago reports, a man on probation for trying to rob a woman on the Red Line train, which, by the way, is a gun-free zone in the city of Chicago, public transportation across the state of Illinois, actually a sensitive place where legally carried firearms are not allowed. Not that that stops bad guys. Anyway, a man on probation for trying to rob a woman on the Red Line train is now accused of trying to rob a man in the River North neighborhood of Chicago while wearing an electronic monitoring bracelet. 35-year-old Robert Snell has now been detained to await trial by Judge Anthony Calabresi. Chicago police, according to CWB Chicago, responded to the 400 block of North State Street around 8:45 on the evening of February 24th after a man who lives in Michigan called 911 to report the robbery attempt. He said a man approached him, indicated that he had a weapon, and then demanded money. Cops had a description of the would-be robber. They detained Mr. Snell in a nearby alley and then arrested him after the victim did visually ID him. In Snell's arrest report, officers noted that he was wearing an ankle monitor on his left leg. According to court records, Snell is on probation for trying to rob a woman on the Red Line train at the Loyola station in December of 2023. In that case, he allegedly confronted the victim, told her, "You have 10 seconds to give me your bag or else I know you have lots of money. Tried to grab her bag and pull it away. Bystanders intervened and called police. He pleaded guilty last November in exchange for a 2-year probationary sentence from Judge Sharon Cantor. So there you go. Got one sweetheart deal. I suppose another is not out of the question, but at least for the time being, Mr. Snell, again, is being detained while he is awaiting trial on these most recent charges, and that should hopefully stop him from committing any more crimes while he is awaiting trial. Although I say hopefully, because the judge can always go back and revise this, right? So he's been ordered detained now, but 2 days from now, 2 weeks from now, the judge could say, yeah, actually, you know what, we're going to put you back on the streets with another ankle monitor device. And by the way, what good is that ankle monitor device if you can go out and still allegedly rob somebody while you're wearing one? All right, on to today's armed citizen story from Brentwood, Tennessee. Now, this actually took place last week. A neighbor shooting a man who was allegedly, well, I guess no allegedly about it. He was stabbing a woman in this Brentwood neighborhood. Brentwood police said that officers were called out to a home on Lost Hollow Drive at approximately 1:15 Wednesday afternoon. So this is broad daylight. They got a 911 call about a man who was stabbing a woman. But before officers arrived on the scene, a neighbor who apparently had a handgun tried to intervene, was unable to stop the suspect from stabbing the woman. And that is when the armed citizen actually shot the suspect multiple times in front of several witnesses, according to WKRN. They report that both the victim and the suspect taken to Vanderbilt University Medical Center after emergency personnel arrived on the scene. The suspected stabber, later identified as 26-year-old Julian Porter, passed away at the hospital. The woman is expected to recover from her injuries. Now, as of last report, officers are still doing an investigation. Again, if everything checks out the way that it has been described, there is virtually no chance that this armed citizen is going to be facing charges. He was acting in defense of others. In fact, I think he very well would have been entitled to use lethal force before Julian Porter stabbed this woman. But after the knife had come down, after it had penetrated the woman's flesh, at that point, you're pretty clearly acting in defense of another, right? So we don't know the name of this armed citizen. We may never know the name of this armed citizen. They're not charged with a crime. I would like to think that the Brentwood police may honor that individual, but they not may not want the attention. But thankfully, again, in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing and saving a woman's life in Brentwood, Tennessee. Now let's turn our attention to another life-saving good deed. This one out of Colorado, where a good Samaritan credited with saving two women who were trapped in their crashed car near Centennial, Colorado. They were submerged in freezing water. They just had a couple of inches of breathing room, according to the Arapahoe County Sheriff's Office. This was back on February 22nd, about 1 o'clock in the morning. Deputies with the Adams County Sheriff's Office got a 911 call for help, but the caller was only saying, please, 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 wasn't responding to questions, couldn't give them any information about where they were located. The emergency rapid SOS system, apparently with the vehicle, showed that there had been a crash, showed generally where this car was located. They responded to the area, but there were no crashes on the roadway. So they're standing there and they're using flashlights. They're trying to see if the car had left the road anywhere. And while they're doing this, a guy flags down the deputies and said, hey, I think there's a car down here. He said that he had seen a black SUV speed by him, fly off the road and into a ditch. So then they start searching this creek bed. Channel 7 in Denver says it was difficult because of the deep snow, the rocks, and the thick vegetation, but they did ultimately see tire tracks. And they were able to follow that down to find this vehicle upside down, submerged in the creek. Sheriff's Office says deputies waded through the water, sometimes chest deep, while breaking ice to reach the vehicle in 22-degree weather. When they finally reached it, they could hear somebody inside screaming and crying, responding to their calls. They were able to force a rear door open. They were able to pull one woman out there. First responders helped her up the embankment. A second woman extricated. They had to use the jaws of life. The women brought to local hospital, and according to the sheriff, they miraculously had only minor injuries. But Patrol Lieutenant Mike Reed says, without the help of that Good Samaritan, they never would have found that car. He said, when I first saw the vehicle, I thought there was no chance of anybody being alive with the amount of damage that it had. He said the women were submerged in freezing water for 15 to 20 minutes with just inches of breathing room. Had we not found them at that moment, they would have succumbed to hypothermia within minutes. And this would have been a completely different outcome. Deputy Helveston with the Arapahoe County Sheriff's Office said the witness was in the right place at the right time. Late at night, barely anyone on the road. Chances of these two women surviving were slim, especially being upside down, submerged in frigid waters with no way to escape. Again, the Good Samaritan has not been named or identified. Police say that both women were, quote, highly intoxicated. And the driver of that vehicle has been charged with DUI. So this is, again, another reminder. It's extra stupid to get behind the wheel of your car when you are impaired and the roads are slippery and slick with snow. It is never a good idea to get behind the wheel of a car when you have had too much to drink, but you already know that. So these women, again, very lucky to be alive after making some poor decisions. And thankfully, again, that Good Samaritan in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing to save these two individuals in need and to lend a helping hand to police who are searching for them. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms Cam and Company. Again, I want to thank you for being a part of the program as always. Looking forward to seeing you back here on Wednesday with another edition of Cam and Company. I'm not sure who we're going to be talking to about these Supreme Court oral arguments. I'm going to be making a few phone calls today, but it's going to be somebody smarter than me, or at least someone who will have had the chance to listen to the oral arguments as they take place tomorrow. I'm going to have to catch it on the replay when the oral arguments are available. You, however, can listen to the oral arguments live. Again, I believe it starts at 10 a.m. tomorrow. I think this is the only oral argument scheduled for the Supreme Court. Docketed for about an hour. And if you just look up Supreme Court live oral arguments live stream, you'll get a link to the Supreme Court's website. They generally will have the oral arguments up within about a day or so. But if you want to listen tomorrow, your best bet is to tune in live. And again, we'll be talking about it on Wednesday. In the meantime, don't forget to check out BearingArms.com. We're keeping you up to date on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information from all across the nation. And if you like what you see, I would encourage you to become a VIP, VIP Gold, or VIP Platinum member. You'll get exclusive benefits with every tier of support, but you will also be supporting the independent pro-Second Amendment journalism that we're doing at Bearing Arms. And we certainly do appreciate that very, very much. So enjoy the rest of your Monday and your 2A Tuesday, and I'll see you back here on Hump Day Wednesday. Until then, be well. Be safe and be free.